Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And what's hot in the news for the past 2 weeks is the fight for abortion rights.
Taking them away.
Yes. Well, so there's two sides. It's the fight to take them away.
And then, the fight to preserve them.
Yeah. So last week we did an episode on Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes.
And a number of states this past week, Alabama, Georgia.
Missouri,
right.
Yeah.
Passed legislation. Was it legislation? No, it was court rulings.
No, these legislation. Okay. So these are bills that have moved through the state legislatures mm-hmm. that are going to the governors for signature that are restricting access to abortion earlier in a woman's pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the specific blowback is that there's such a huge lack of understanding and lack of application of medical science to these bills. A lot of women do not realize that they are pregnant until around the same time that these bills are criminalizing or attempting to criminalize abortion. So this is being taken as definitely an aggression toward moving ultimately toward overturning Roe v. Wade. And abortion has been put at the forefront of the culture wars, you know, these issues that pit so-called conservatives against so-called liberals. And a lot of times these issues are more than meets the eye. Mm-hmm. So even today, we're going to examine how the abortion debate is about more than just the sanctity of life or the so-called sanctity of life. It's about a lot of stuff.
Right. And we know that it's about a lot of things. It's just that it becomes difficult to articulate that argument because of the inflammatory language that's around the issue.
Not only that, but there's an evolving strategy of just constantly moving the goalpost, you know, depending on where you get the most traction on your issue, you begin to change language and reframe arguments because it fits your ultimate goals. Mm-hmm. So these things are happening so fast. You know, we've talked about the crushing weight of the 24-hour news cycle. We've talked about the influence of social media where information is not always properly vetted and it can be easily shared. Things can go viral and they're not even real.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is that our media has always participated in some form of sensationalism, and issues like this are not an exception to sensationalism. So you do have a little bit of that going on. And then this is just another one of those things that is just reflecting this tenor amongst people who have identified themselves as supposedly the most moral authorities on these mm-hmm. culture issues. And when you begin to peel back the layers, there's, you know, some things that need to be cleared up. There's some ugliness there.
So Roe v. Wade was a 1973 decision by the Supreme Court that basically granted the right to privacy in case of abortion, or extended the privacy under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to abortions.
Mm-hmm.
This came as a result of a case Norma McCovey, identified as Jane Roe at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to protect her privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Sued Henry Ward, who was the Dallas District Attorney.
Mm-hmm.
In this situation, she was pregnant, and this was the third pregnancy that she experienced. The first one, she had let the children live with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, she gave the child up for adoption. She realized she was pregnant again and wanted to
not go through right, with the
not,
pregnancy.
She wanted to terminate the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Dallas, the abortions were illegal unless there was an issue with the health of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
She did not qualify for that. And so she was not able or not granted the right to receive an abortion. She thought to pursue it illegally. Friends of hers who were lawyers said, no, we're going to go through this process. They talked her into going through the process.
Mm-hmm.
She did go through the process. And this case started in 1971. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And they ruled in 73.
Mm-hmm.
She ended up having the child and giving up that child for adoption. Now, we talked about Brown versus Board last week.
Yes.
There aren't a lot of cases that people recognize from the Supreme Court.
Right.
The Supreme Court does a lot of work.
A lot.
But most of the things appear innocuous to most of us.
Mm-hmm.
But decisions like these landmark decisions, are what enter into the public consciousness. And mm-hmm. this was definitely one of those times.
Yes. So in moving this case forward, so let's just frame this up. At the time, the United States had just was continuing, rather, not that we weren't finished. We were continuing an evolving civil rights movement. So after the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s, so what is that? Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65, Housing Rights of 68. Nixon is now in office and the issues are starting to evolve, and there is energy from feminist movement.
Yeah, you have the feminist movement going at the same time.
Yeah.
So civil rights, the feminist movement.
Yeah, and like this is another, and this is not different from what happened in the 19th century. You make a move with race and then here comes, you know, gender. Mm-hmm. So Roe v. Wade actually extended this due process clause to women specifically, because we're talking about issues evolving around pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And it was not necessarily immediately a touchstone issue. It was a touchstone issue with Catholics, yeah, more so, not necessarily all of the major Christian sects. I'm not saying that we were really with it. I'm just saying that this was, you know, when it came to Catholicism and right, that particular voting block, they had huge issues.
So let's back up. Last week, we talked about Brown and mm-hmm, how that 1954 decision in the Supreme Court was fought for decades. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Christian obsession with this abortion rights issue, and it has its roots in Brown.
Yes.
So what happened was the states began to fight Brown to uphold the right to segregate their schools.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is going on from the 50s through the 60s into the 70s.
Yes.
Okay, so what happens is in 1971, the Supreme Court had ruled that racially discriminatory schools would not be able to uphold their tax-exempt status.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you had Christian schools who were trying to
segregate
the schools at the academies, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Supreme Court said, okay, we can't stop you from doing that, but if you're going to do that, you're going to lose this exemption.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically it'll make the school be unable to function.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's a young guy. His name is Paul Weyrich. And we discussed him all the way back in episode 2. But we're going back again because this is episode 99. So Paul Weyrich wanted to build a political voting bloc. And he wanted to target Christians because he saw that there was this energy on the Christian side with what was happening in the courts. Before Roe v. Wade, there were abortion fights throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw that the Christians were actually looking at not necessarily the abortion issue, but they were looking at different issues, but they weren't voting together. And he reasoned that if he could get them voting on the same issue,
mm-hmm,
then he could build the political power that he needed to propel his career and his agenda. Okay, so Christians now are starting to move away from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party.
Now, would you think that, because I want to clarify this for the listening audience, is he targeting Christians or is he targeting a specific type of Christian?
No, right now he's not targeting anything. He just sees that there's a swing politically from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party because of these fears of the Cold War, and their Christian champion, Billy Graham, now has this open relationship with
the president,
Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christians are looking at their leader, Billy Graham, and the Crusades and saying, oh, he's friendly with them. Maybe we should look at what's going on with them. They can help us solve this Russia mm-hmm problem. And then there's this ongoing suspicion around Catholicism. Now, we're not going to go into long history, but
right,
in the American Revolutionary War, when the colonies fought England,
mm-hmm,
the Anglican Church took a huge hit. Now, any church that was part of that Church of England, the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church, they were looked at with great suspicion. And that held throughout history from the end of the war all the way to now. And so you got all of these forces working together. And so they're looking now at the Republican Party, and Weyrich sees an opportunity there.
Okay.
So what he does is, it's not abortion, it's these segregated academies that he tries to move through first.
Mm-hmm. Segregated private schools.
Okay, so this court case is called Green versus Connolly in 1971, where the Supreme Court said that you lose your tax exempt status if you segregate. Weyrich looks at that and says, all right, well, the Christians are mad about that because they're saying that they can't have their own schools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to use that to generate the momentum to actually get this group of people voting in a block. So he identified another case since they lost Green versus Connolly. He had identified a school, Bob Jones University, which was a Christian school,
right,
who outright said, we're not allowing African Americans into the school.
Right.
The government requested, like sent a questionnaire, and they explicitly
regarding
said
regarding their compliance.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they were brazen about this. And so the IRS said, we're taking away a tax exempt status. Bob Jones University sued. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. And they lost.
They lost.
So during this time, the Roe versus Wade case is happening. So the Bob Jones case doesn't go to the Supreme Court, I think, until the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not resolved until 1983.
Right.
Roe is in 1973. But as they're going through this process, Paul Weyrich, who is now linked up with Jerry Falwell, who was very disappointed by the Roe v. Wade decision, they're linked together and they're seeing that they're not getting the traction that they want out of this segregation issue in which they ultimately lost.
Right.
So they switched
the
tactic.
And the optics are not good.
The optics are not good.
Yeah.
We're going to form a moral majority on the fact that we're going to discriminate against a whole group of people.
Oh my God. Okay.
So Christians weren't buying it en masse.
Right.
Or at least overtly.
Not overtly.
So they switched the tactic because of Roe v. Wade and saw that Christians didn't care really at the time, but by 1979, which is 6 years after the decision, then they began to build this momentum where they can actually get some attention yep. on this issue from Christians.
Where they can obscure certain language, they can manipulate the framing of the issue to hide true intent, right? So if I frame up my disagreement with the issue by claiming the moral authority to want to do as God would want us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to take my, you know, consider myself a platform and a mouthpiece for what a Judeo-Christian God would want us to do in a certain situation. That is completely different from me appearing to just say, I don't want my kids to go to school with your kids, which is a very basic way to describe a lot of the agitation that happened after Brown. Last week, we talked about how funding for schools being tied to property taxes and how movement within the community actually affects how good your schools appear to be. So when all of your tax base decides to not participate in the shoring up of public education, that shows for whatever students are left to only have access to those schools.
Mm-hmm.
Part of testing the legislation that we're discussing around Brown had to do with how far can we go without violating federal law.
Mm-hmm.
Even as these cases are going along, you have whole communities moving through, you know, grade school, high school, pretty much protected in their practices because cases have not been finally decided. So by 83, we're now saying that the optics don't look good on trying to prop up racism proper, just, you know, in your face. So how else can we influence a conversation and influence other people's behavior and have this authority and obscure the fact that we're actually moving in a direction, like maybe we find a new way to limit people's rights, limit people's participation in our systems, in our institutions?
So as part of this new way, Weyrich, who, by the way, does not care about the moral aspect of this
no,
at all.
This is a power
he
play.
Wants political power.
Yep.
In the future, he goes on to found the Heritage Foundation, which is still active.
Yes.
Even though,
and still influential.
Right. Still very influential. Paul Weyrich has since died. God trouble his soul. I don't care. But the Heritage Foundation is a staunchly conservative right wing group.
Yes.
And then Weyrich also went on to influence the American Legislative Executive Council, ALEC, who formed all of these bills mm-hmm. around different forms of oppression in the United States. So he's chasing power. This is yes. the moment when he's actually amassing that power.
Mm-hmm.
So he enlists Francis Schaeffer, who is this theologian who becomes the theological voice for this movement. Now, Schaeffer had this focus on secular humanism, and basically he was saying that the government now is moving us away from God into a secular governing space, mm-hmm. and they're going to take away your rights. They've already done it with the right to form your own schools. They are taking away the right
which
to
nobody
protect.
Said you couldn't form your own schools. They just said you couldn't use those schools exactly. to discriminate against
exactly.
other children.
But those Christians wanted to discriminate, right. and so now right. we can't do it. They're taking away your right to protect these, they would say, unborn children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's how the movement started. Same time you got Jimmy Carter now as president. Now, Jimmy Carter is a Democratic president. He was trying to play both sides. They wanted him to put forth a constitutional amendment to combat the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
Carter did not do that. So you have another person running for office during.
Dun, 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 dun.
So you have a young upstart Republican from the state of California.
Former actor.
Yeah. Goes by the name of Ronald Reagan.
Ooh-cha.
Who had no problem passing a pretty liberal abortion law in California that prohibited abortions.
Mm-hmm.
And so Reagan ends up winning in that election. Falwell goes on to claim that
we did that.
We did that. Mm-hmm. Now, there were other factors involved.
Definitely.
But the people believed Falwell.
And that's and all you need for that, the people to believe.
Yeah. So they thought that they got Reagan in office. Mm-hmm. And now you have your political moral majority voting bloc that now has all
it's
this.
Active. It can see itself. It believes in its own power. Now, behind this issue, and you move Reagan into power, there are still a number of people who vilify this particular presidency, what Reagan's policies mm-hmm. did. You know, we talk about leadership and one issue voting. This mm-hmm. came up before. When you participate in one issue voting, you actually put yourself in danger to get run over by other issues. So for people who might not have been paying attention to the economic portion of his platform, or might not have been paying attention to the foreign relations portion of his platform, to get in coalition behind his campaign on this one issue made a lot of sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on your economic status, and depending on your business interests, depending on your lens and how you see the world and how you see Americans in the world, you suffer in other ways
mm-hmm.
under his leadership.
Yeah.
So Reagan is, to me, most notable for two things: the war on drugs and trickle down economics,
mm-hmm.
both of which devastated Black communities and, you know, Black and brown communities. The sentencing disparities between crack and powder cocaine. These are Reagan era policies.
Yep.
Using RICO to prosecute street gangs to ensure that there's this ratcheting up of the time and giving life sentences for nonviolent offenders because they have drug charges and things of this nature. These are all of the quality of life issues mm-hmm. that were affected. You elect your man, you elect your person to office, but these are some of the things that, you know, even history right now is repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
People who are one issue voters on immigration are paying the price on other things because you want a wall, but you don't realize you are going to sacrifice access to health care and other, you know, quality of life issues.
So now you have Christians in a block feeling very empowered or emboldened
mm-hmm.
by what they can do if they organize. Okay, so
let's talk about it.
Yeah, because the thing is, when Roe actually was handed down, the Christians, like we said, didn't care about it. There was a
they did not care at the level that you would think. I don't think that, because I want to be clear about this. They did not care, nor were they moving in a political block that would reflect that. So they're not affecting legislative change at the state level. They are not sending forth cases as challenges because Roe is just going down. And mm-hmm. But it's not to say that individual Christians did
not
care.
Right. So we're not saying everyone didn't care, but they didn't care in the way that we see the care
that we see
exhibited
the issue.
Now.
Yeah.
All right. So there was a pastor, Southern Baptist Convention, former president, W.A. Criswell, who at the time when Roe was decided had said, "I have always felt that it was only after a child was born and had a life separate from its mother that it became an individual person.
Mm-hmm.
And it has always therefore seemed to me that what is best for the mother and for the future should be allowed." This was his response to Roe v. Wade. Right. There's a reason why at this point in history that a pastor now can have this type of, he's a pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, that he can have this type of reaction. And the idea is from the Old Testament. We talk about how sometimes abortion is not really an issue that the Bible raises. It does raise, and we're going to get to that.
Yes.
But the issue of life is handled in the Bible in many places.
Yes, it is.
Now, the problem is connecting life the way we understand it now with a fetus versus what was understood at the time when Roe v. Wade and throughout history until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
Life was initiated at the moment when a breath was taken.
Yes.
Okay, so this is a very old idea going all the way back to Genesis 2 mm-hmm. when God formed the human, the man, and then breathed the breath of life. That Hebrew word is rock or ruach. And that is the word that's used throughout the Old Testament for spirit, for wind, for breath of life. That is what's understood to be when life occurs.
Yes.
So they didn't have this concept of life existing in the womb because no breath was taken. There was not a possibility for that to happen. And so this is how Christians understood this. In Job 27:3 and Job 12:10 and Ecclesiastes 12:7, they highlight that this is the way that you understand when life begins.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get to where we are now, Christians have had to understand that differently.
Reinterpret. It's right. Not a different understanding. They've now, had to. We talked about literalism. We talked about biblical literalism. Yep. And we attributed some of this literal behavior to people who would identify more so as these types of conservatives. I take the Bible at its word. Well, if you take the Bible at its word and it demonstrates that almost the requirement for life, for human life, is breath to be in action, mm-hmm. breathing to be in action. Then how do we move to heartbeat bills? How right. do we do that? That is a political adeptness that is redefining for political expediency what life actually is.
So you have Christians who are professing to believe the Bible, but changing what the Bible says about this issue in order to further their political
agenda. Secular power. Yeah.
The Bible doesn't really talk about abortion in those terms. That language is not there, especially in the New Testament. There's nothing like that.
Right.
But if we look in the Old Testament, we see a couple things that actually inform how those who wrote the Bible or the culture that the Bible was written in would view this issue. So the first one is Exodus 21 verses 22 through 25.
Exodus 21, 22 through 25 says, when people who are fighting injure a pregnant woman so that there is a miscarriage and yet no further harm follows, the one responsible shall be fined what the woman's husband demands, paying as much as the judges determine. Verse 23, if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life. 24, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. 25, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe.
This passage is basically identifying a situation where pregnancy is prevented from going to term
mm-hmm.
through injury to the woman.
Yes.
Now, this could be set up as an argument against abortion because it seems very similar to, I think it was the Alabama bill that says doctors are penalized up to 99 years
in jail. In prison. Crazy.
Yeah. So that kind of resembles this. But what this does that's not happening now is this does not penalize the woman for being in the situation.
Right.
So
it assumes that she's injured, that she's a victim of something.
Right.
And calls for compensation for her loss.
So the fact that a lot of these bills are coming up and ignoring the injury element to what's going on, i.e. if a situation of sexual assault.
Yeah. Rape, incest, yeah. The health of the mother.
Again, to read abortion into the Bible, you really have to extrapolate a lot. There aren't a lot of places. There's really only two.
Right.
And that's the one. Again, the mother's not penalized. The second one is Numbers 5:11-31. Now, this passage is really rough.
Yes.
We're not going to read the whole thing. But to give you an overview, the passage starts in verse 11 where it says, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, and then what's going on to be said after that is just, it's so problematic for so many reasons.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So read it. It's Numbers 5, 11 through 31. What happens basically in this story, if a husband suspects his wife of cheating, the husband is supposed to bring the wife to this priest. The priest is supposed to create this concoction. The concoction is called the water of bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Made out of dirt, some liquid, and the wife is supposed to stand before the priest with the husband present, drink this water. If her belly bloats, she's guilty of the offense. Says the womb discharges, and that is how they handle a suspicion of infidelity by the husband. This requires no proof.
None.
The proof happens after this procedure is forced.
Yes.
This is about how. So listen, in verse 21.
Okay.
Let the priest make the woman take an oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you an execration and an oath among our people. When the Lord makes your uterus drop, your womb discharge. Now, may this water that brings the curse enter your bowels and make your womb discharge, your uterus drop. And the woman shall say, amen, amen. This is a horrible, horrible procedure.
Yeah, I don't have the words.
Yeah. So this is highlighting the lack of agency that this woman has.
Yes. And as property to her husband.
And the abuse of power that is going on among the priest and the men. And this is attributing this to God. So what you're seeing here is pretty much a forced abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Based on this suspicion.
To placate the suspicions of a husband. And it comes to be called, this is the law of jealousy, verse 29. This is the law of jealousy when a wife, while under the husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, or when the spirit of jealousy comes upon a man and he becomes jealous of his wife, then he shall stand the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall execute all this law upon her. Then the man shall be free from iniquity, but that woman shall bear her guilt.
This is all kinds of horrible.
It's horrible.
This is not about abortion.
At all.
Yet, this is the closest thing that the Bible has to
an abortion.
Dealing with that. And mm-hmm. The abortion is the prescription, which this is, I've been on this passage for over 2 months just because it's hard to deal with. Like, I don't know. I want to be sensitive to, and I'm probably messing this up completely now, but I want to be sensitive to all the dynamics that are at play in the text.
Right.
And so I had at one point, I had put an article up on the site, but then I took it down. I got some input from a friend and was like, nah, you may want to look at it this way. Or this is a little bit tough. And so I pulled it down and I just been working through it.
Mm-hmm.
But now that this issue is coming up,
mm-hmm.
These are the type of things that do not get preached in church, do not get handled. And this one specifically, this is a tough one to handle.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for the presence of an abortion in scripture, you're not going to find it. The closest thing that you're going to find is this.
Mm-hmm.
In the case in which, for horrible reasons, this is saying God prescribes it.
Right. Well, we're moving through this discussion, and I think it's just important to say, while yes, we are talking about this abortion fight, we really have to get real about what we're really talking about. We're talking about a woman's ability to secure for herself the quality of life that she has determined that she needs access to, and the level of medical care that mm-hmm. she has determined that she needs access to. And I just want to make this very real, because we can talk about it and frame it up in its rooting and talk about, you know, the different factions that would love to see themselves in control. You know, yes, we're talking about control politically, but this has very real ramifications when people cannot, you know, access health care.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're talking about. Women get pregnant. They get pregnant. And that happens for a host of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens, and there are people who are planning for children, and something happens early or during their pregnancy that makes medical intervention necessary.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are not planning for children, who have experienced a failure in their birth control or a failure in their decision-making processes, one or the other, and having to raise a child is not, I'm not talking about inconvenient. I'm not talking about being confused about you know, how am I going to pay for it? I'm talking about having a child in the living situation that that person is currently existing in. It is not good for the child.
Mm-hmm.
The same people who are standing or wanting to stand on this political authority about abortion have nothing to say about the glut of children that are existing between different levels of hell in foster care, going uncared for in a way that we would think that this same so-called moral authority would provide care for these children, to the point where, you know, you've heard in certain places, oh, you're pro-birth, you're not pro-life, because what happens to the life of the child after they're brought here? So we're not just talking about men or people fighting over what a woman's going to do with her body. I have to at least acknowledge that there are a lot of women who know that sometimes bodies, you know, people weaponize themselves against you. We can talk about emotional pain, you know, in a situation, a relationship. There are people who know that, you know, if somebody can jam up their life plan or get them to drop out of school or get them, you know, to stay home, they can do that with a pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, you know, they can't beat it out of you. Maybe they're not a woman beater, but your ass is always pregnant. All the time. And that's not an inconvenience. That's not taking nothing away from people who want to be mothers or be parents or do whatever. But there is such a thing as weaponizing pregnancy against women to limit their opportunities or to limit their say-so in how they move. I will always be an advocate for a woman's right to choose, and having a right to choose doesn't necessarily mean that I'm choosing that, you know, I don't love children or I don't see the value in growing a family. I'm choosing to do it when it is best. I'm best able to handle that responsibility. And I know way too many people who have had to face that question. It is an intensely personal question. And ultimately, you know, taking nothing away from active fathers and men who intend to support, sometimes things go awry. Your best laid plans get blown up and you have to really decide, can you do that? Nobody's having kids so that they can be mediocre.
Right.
You know, nobody's having kids so that they can be hungry. Nobody's having kids so that they get caught up in other parts of this system because they're uncared for.
A legislative remedy cannot account for the variance of situations where pregnancy occurs. So
exactly.
You mentioned birth control fails. We talked earlier about sexual assault. Those are unwanted pregnancies. Poor decision making.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do if you barely have the money? You find yourself able to go to college. Then you find yourself pregnant because your birth control failed. Now you have to make a decision.
Yes.
Am I going to miss this entire opportunity to do this thing? Or am I going to, I don't have the resources. Maybe I don't have the support system. Like you have to think through your personal situation. And by mm-hmm. saying it's a personal choice, the government cannot account for the
all
different variables in those choices.
And I do not think that a woman who considers the full spectrum of her options should she find herself pregnant, because we always say that, you know, these choices are subjective to some sort of emotional or mental battle about whether or not to become a parent. And sometimes it's not that. Sometimes it's, do I want children mm-hmm. or not? I don't know why it freaks some people out, for lack of a better term, but it's like knowing that a woman could have sex. Like, these battles used to be over birth control too. Should she be able to stop herself from becoming pregnant if she's participating in sex?
Right.
I mean, I want to have sex. I don't necessarily want to have a child. I've talked to even elders in my family where their families were large because of the lack of, you know, birth control or family planning access that they had. Not because they were just like, I didn't want to have the sex. I've actually had it said to me, I wanted the sex. I didn't so much want the child.
Mm.
But it's the 40s. It's the 50s. What are your real options?
Yeah. So I almost feel like all of the use cases are attempting to justify why a woman should be able to make this choice.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why the woman should be able to make the choice is because it's her choice.
Well, she's the one ultimately.
And it doesn't matter which use case you present.
Yeah.
Someone can say, well, what about this case? It's not about the cases. It's not about the examples.
That's whataboutism.
Right. It is about the fact that it is this person Do they have the ability to make a choice for themselves?
Mm-hmm. And we are in a system that is still very unsettled on whether or not a historically marginalized group should be able to have this level of self-determination. To me, it's a no-brainer, but look at what all the different parts that it's evolved into. And people are discussing this like, yeah, it's going to be hard for you, but it's not going to be hard for that other powerful person when his mistress gets pregnant. She will have access to the very same thing that is criminalized for the lower income woman, you know, who's not well known, who's not well connected. That's an inequity that's not supported by the present, you know, on the face or the rule of law. That's an inequity that's on the face of elitism. And it's always been that way. We talk about back alley abortions, which is just a term that came to cover the whole umbrella of these previously illegal procedures. Right. So it's like you had the same choices in front of you, had the same circumstances and considerations in front of you, but you didn't have access to a healthy medical intervention. So you could mess around and die trying to take care of yourself. This is just too high of a price to pay. And it speaks to the disposability of one human being for another. And I think this is an argument that we make in cases where race is the issue, or in cases where equal access and equal protection are the ultimate bedrock of the issue being discussed. You're trying to argue one person's viability over the other.
The control that is attempting to be exerted throughout this process and over these decisions appears, the argument is made from a Christian standpoint. Now, we've talked about how Christians were basically conned by a political upstart who wanted to increase his political profile, conned into thinking that this is one of the chief biblical issues or the things that God cares about. God didn't care enough about it to put it in a book, not in any definitive way. We talked about how the Bible in the Old Testament, in rabbinic scriptures, quantify life. It is through breath. This is why when you pass out in a restaurant, they want to know, are you breathing? Are you okay? This is how it's always been until very recently, starting in the 1980s when this fight started to ratchet up. We haven't talked about the bullshit position that anyone that is anti-abortion is pro-life.
It's bullshit, and I just don't even want to go into it. Yeah,
so we don't have to do that. We know that their argument or their life only so exists illogical. Inside the womb, and nothing outside the womb really matters.
The policies just go head to head with one another. Okay. It doesn't make sense.
Also, basing it on the Bible, you are basing it on scriptures who, at many points, exert control over women. Women are seen as property.
Right.
They don't have the ability to make their own decisions.
And we talk about cultural context when the Bible was written versus being able to apply principles. And that is not changing God's word. That is intelligence. Like,
It's just reason.
Yeah, so, we're just asking for people to be intelligent.
So here we are in 2019 attempting to exert the same type of control from a culture in antiquity, based on little to no evidence and devoid of any reasonable argument. But why is this? Why are women the target of this?
We've always been the target.
I know it seems like a lot to just put on you to answer.
We're just talking about it, but I just see my viewpoint is always going to be skewed. When I put myself in the center of it, you know, I've said in conversation, the womb of Black women built the Western world. So when you commoditize children, when you have commoditized human beings to the point that they can be bought and sold, that becomes inventory. Okay. Now, some people be like, oh man, that sounds so crazy. You know,
it's not. Slaves come from somewhere.
Hell no. They come from somewhere. They have a value. And when you create a market demand says that if it's too many, your price is going to go low. If it's not enough, the price is going to go high. So we have some demographic shifts that are in play right now that are making the price of life very, very, very high. So that's one thing. Two, I wouldn't take anything off the table. Just like a business forecast, you know, where it would be where should we grow? You know, where should we put our new headquarters? Where should we build our stores? People look at data and make data tell them stories about all sorts of things. So if I want to build houses, if I want to build malls, if I want to build cars, if I want to build schools, if I want to build jails, if I want to build anything that serves humans, I kind of have to know where the humans are going to be. On the one end, you wouldn't think. I remember I had a conversation with friends where I said, okay, so you wouldn't believe that a private prison organization is asking for PTA participation data. You wouldn't believe it because you don't see how these two things are connected. You wouldn't believe that a private prison organization is interested in the literacy rates of fourth graders. You just wouldn't believe it. But you know why they are? Because they already know that a certain number of their population doesn't read beyond a certain level. So if you're struggling by the fourth grade, I can plan beds for you. That's just the nature of this particular capitalist society where we have not said no to any business that can be built on the backs of ultimately children. You see what I mean? So the more power and the more control that we have, the individual has, that's usurping control from other institutions, organizations, other authorities. So if I have the power to limit my participation in your larger system, that might undercut your bottom line. This is a capitalist society and we've only evolved, right? So when we've looked at, you know, what did the 13th Amendment do and not do? It said, all right, slaves are free unless they got charges. And then what did we watch happen? We watched the growth of a whole nother population that fit that. I mean, it's a comma in a sentence, but that comma is so important because we've disenfranchised voters. We've broken up families. We've definitely limited people's life and livelihood just off that comma because I said you were free except, not free absolute, but free except. I feel like the conversation should always be that large because I just feel like that, again, reflects intelligence. Don't piss on me and tell me it's raining. Don't tell me that this is about a heartbeat bill in the same pen that you're going to sign that with is the same pen that you're limiting Medicaid expansion. Don't tell me that this is about the sanctity of life and the same pen that you sign that bill with is going to be the same pen that you double my child's potential to go to prison for a number of years versus yours. Don't sign that bill and say, you know, children have a right to be here. And with the same pen, you are limiting my access to healthy food. You're limiting my access to healthy housing. You're limiting my access to solid education that because you're so worried about me competing with you, but you don't realize that we're all competing with other areas of the world. Just don't. You know what I mean? And at this point, the stakes are so high. You're passing heartbeat bills, but y'all are the same people who don't care about children being in jail. They too are innocent. They speak Spanish. So what? They're from different places. And it's not just, you know, children coming through the border. It doesn't make sense. It's not sustainable.
So last week we talked about Brown and how the effects of the fight against the Supreme Court ruling in which states would shutter whole school districts and basically catch up all of these people they never intended to reach.
Collateral damage.
Yeah, all this collateral damage of uneducated and undereducated people and how that affected this country's position in the world in medicine, in sciences, in technology.
We are suffering.
And we're suffering as a country right for now. It. This is another example of this. We talked about in Brown. This is kind of like a two-part episode. So right. Brown kind of lays the foundation for what we're seeing in this Roe battle. Brown, they had all these individual cases going up to the Supreme Court where they bundled them together to go in as Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. That's why you're seeing so many bills right now, because the hope is to bundle them up and get them to the Supreme Court. Now, here's where the Democratic Party is short-sighted compared to the GOP. Mm-hmm. For over two decades, the Federalist Society, which is an organization, not necessarily an advocacy organization, but an organization here in Washington, D.C., has worked to fill the federal bench with conservative judges for the explicit purpose of overturning the decision that we're talking about now. Washington Post had a great write-up on this guy, Leonard Leo, who is vice president of the Federalist Society and also an advisor, unofficial advisor in this administration. So basically what happens is, long ago they realized we're going to win at the bench because we can't really control what happens at the poll.
Exactly.
So they bide their time. And when they play the long game better than anyone that we've seen. This is building off of Wyrick's move to gain this political capital. The Federalist Society is doing the same thing, and right now they're winning. So they wait until Republican president is in office, and then they push through federal judges. Activity decreases when there's a Democratic president in office. They work on building
the bench,
the bench so they know which nominees to put forward when that flips, and they get the opportunity to put those judges in the bench. And so you're seeing a press now of federal judges being populated in the federal bench.
And they don't even talk about it. They don't. We looked at Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh was one.
Gorsuch.
Gorsuch was one. Clarence Thomas was one. Alito was one. Roberts was one. They got all of these judges through to try to lean the court a certain way.
Well, I'm just going to say, I think Roberts has a little bit of Warren in him, because sometimes he's his own swing vote. Like, he hasn't always reliably voted the conservative judges.
So Roberts is breaking tradition. He came out of this Federalist Society pool. Like, he was identified by this group to serve as a justice. So the fact that he's doing what he's doing now
I think he's concerned about posterity.
Right.
Yeah.
Just be mindful that there are forces working behind the scenes, and they have been, and they will continue to be for decades. It's nice that we get out and vote. That's the right thing to do. That's not all you can do, because there's so many other things working against you. If you populate the federal bench overwhelmingly with conservative judges, these type of decisions now where you see tax returns released, those won't happen. Halting the separation of children at the border.
That won't happen.
We had a whole show about the federal bench.
We did.
We talked last week about the Supreme Court. We're talking this week about the Supreme Court and the overall fight and the Christian bullshit that goes along with this fight and how it is formed. But just be mindful that this is a big fight that's going to go beyond this news cycle, beyond 2020. This has been going on since the 80s where they've built this, and they're not going to stop because they are winning it right now.
And it's a masterclass in patience. It's a masterclass in strategy. And you got to figure that this country is so young. This country is young. I remember when I was traveling and I was in Italy and I was standing in a piazza or something. And I was looking at two churches.
You fancy.
Fancy. Okay, sister had a good job. I'm standing in a square in a piazza, and I was looking at two churches that were older than this country proper, right? The churches were built in 1641 and 1645, and we didn't get a constitution till 1787. So that just puts things into perspective that we are very young. We are like the teenagers behind the wheel of the Ferrari because of our economy and our power and our legend almost. Americans have to square up with the fact that American exceptionalism is at best a lie that stops you from doing what you're supposed to do. And because we've denied American exceptionalism, quote unquote, to other groups of people all over the world, they've worked harder because they're trying to overcome this idea of American exceptionalism. We're horribly outmatched in certain ways. And it's not to say that first of all, I am an American, whether I like it or not, but I'm not saying that I hate this place. I'm saying that y'all can't compete. You know, if you haven't really worked on being at the top of your real game, then you can't compete. The continuous underinvestment in education. Most people had said it's going to come to a point where we're going to have to pay for this. Right now, we're paying for passion over facts, how I feel about a situation versus what the facts are. The fact of the matter is, the evidence that people point to that abortion has to be this long, drawn out court battle about protecting the sanctity of life, it is bullshit. It is. It is bullshit because the longer arc of history has said that you disrupted a very powerful economy when certain things happened within the culture. People who were making money in that economy never agreed to stop making money. And I'm not talking about slave owners. I'm talking about everybody tied to that machine said, but we can't be broke.
Money's too good.
Money's too good. We invented money. Like, we need it. We need it. We're dominating. This is capitalism is going to be the way by which we dominate the world. Okay, cool. This abortion thing is a distraction. It is something way bigger and way more nefarious going on. We can't even get to a conclusion on this show without discussing how we always romanticize how we're going to hurt one another. So we're talking about this, and this is real. So there's this pop culture phenomenon as a show and a movie that shows what could possibly happen when you vacate your facts for your feelings and you give people who have no moral authority all of your political power. Of course, I'm talking about Handmaid's Tale.
Airing on June 5th, again, season 3. This is the end game.
So full disclosure, I saw the movie. I don't watch the show. It makes me very uncomfortable.
And I haven't seen the movie, but I do watch the show.
Okay, so here's where it is. And we kind of discussed this a little bit, but it is so disturbing how it has been imagined to rob a woman of her agency in the name of God and growing families for elites at the expense of people who cannot repel them politically or within their own power, within their own might.
So let me give you a synopsis without spoiling anything.
Okay.
The show is about, there's an inability of many women to bear children.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this court fight and they're going through these decisions about what to do to resolve the issue. Some of the women can have children. There becomes this elite class of wealthy people who are able to force those who still can bear children to have children. They become a handmaid. That comes from the Bible, like Hagar, who was a handmaid or a womb slave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these handmaids serve in the homes of this elite class.
This is so cringy.
Right. So let's say there's a husband and a wife in a house and they have a handmaid. In order for them to have a child, the handmaid is basically impregnated by the husband. This is not with consent. They're forced to do this. Impregnated by the husband, forced to bear a child. When they bear the child, the family keeps the child. The handmaid moves to the next house to do it all over again. So these women don't have any ability to make any choices about their reproductive rights. And it is horrible. Like the United States,
in this dystopian
future, the United States is looking terrible to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
To other countries, they look at what's going on here. Some look at it and want to model it. Some look at it and say how awful this is for different people. But we see what's happening. You have a wealthy ruling class. You have a poor class who has no choice in what happens with their body.
Mm-hmm.
This show is horrible. And I got drawn into it because I'm watching it. I'm like, that looks exactly like what they want to do.
Exactly. First of all, it looks like partially what's been done. You know, we talk about and people have been allowed to talk about African-American history as if it is separate from the greater picture of American history. Okay. Once importation stopped, that's exactly what was going on. You could be made pregnant by any man, be they another slave or anyone. The only person who could defend you would be whoever owned you, who decided that that was an offense. Then you're having the child. Now, this is cringy, but then you have that child and that child's not even yours. And you don't know when your faux custody over your own child ends. You don't know. You don't know if you've gone and taken, because you got to understand what society was at that time. So you went to go deliver dresses a half a day's horse ride away. You came back. Your child is gone. And your child is gone not because they wandered away, because somebody sold them. Somebody gave them away. So in a moment, you're a childless mother, and your defenseless young person is wherever they are. And don't let your defenseless young person be a girl. You already know what their life is going to be. Many generations of our ancestors, our forebears, went to the grave not knowing that we would even be in the position that we're in now. You have to honor that. Don't let them tell you. Don't let anybody fucking lie to you and say, we would never do that. You've already fucking done it. And that is so, yes, I get angry. But I get angry because you cannot manipulate language to the point where you distort your whole historical record. You've already done it. You've already done it. And dare I say that the self-determination, the determination of the people to not come under that level of oppression, that level of tyranny, has shocked those who are in power. And they've been trying to figure out how to break that shit ever since. Period. Stop making it seem like the shit is polite. It's not fucking polite.
So we're in the end game now. This fight that you're seeing, the groundwork has been laid for decades. They are killing us.
They're coming for your ass. Like, pay attention. And it's not for nothing. My thing is just, you know, get your head out your ass. They've already done it. Yes. You're not waiting for the future as much as they're trying to bring back a past. Being able to imagine things, having your imagination, I don't think people can imagine the level of wealth that was born and continues to flow out of this particular system. I've said it many times. Capitalism eats her children. Capitalism want to eat your children. Don't want you to make those decisions for yourself. Pay attention.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.